www.bayoulandconservancy.org or find us on social media. KPFT Houston.
Signals 8 p.m. Wednesday, and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it is right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton, along with an ensemble of gifted hosts, Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder, Greg Audell, appearing with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and Dr. Warren Holloman, our master of wellness. These guys, gotta mention I have desexed the word guys, so that refers to any gender. These guys are not only gifted hosts, they are great storytellers. And rounding out our team are our chief production engineer and media director, Nicole Rocherlin, and our intern, Tatiana Gago. Together with our guest storytellers that we bring on the show every week, we celebrate the power of story. Tonight I have a special guest as our storyteller, Robert Wolpe. And let me tell you, I have been working to get him on the show for a while. He is a professional musician, a trumpeter, who also teaches and inspires young musicians. In addition to his teaching and professional activities with the Houston Symphony, Bob is the director of the Houston Brass Band. When I first met Bob, it was a great night. It was Spaghetti Night, which is a fundraiser at the Houston School for the Performing Arts, Performing and Visual Arts. And I started listening to these stories that ranged from physics to fathers to music. And as dissonant as it sounds, I was enthralled. You have to think of this as a composition of stories that come together like a composition of music for an orchestra does, composed of disparate parts but leaving you in a state of peaceful contentment at the end. So I'm hoping that all of you all in Radioland will remember the individual stories but also enjoy the fusion. So curl up and listen in. I am going to begin to direct this symphony. Bob, welcome to the show. I have to imagine that as a performer, you've been on the radio before.
Well, your imagination serves you well.
And as we met, and you've told me many of your stories, I realize that you have a great story about your father and you and how you came to play the trumpet.
Well, yeah. Prior to my parents' divorce, I played violin. My mother was a professional violinist and violist in Hollywood in the studios and a little bit with the LA Philharmonic. So I played violin and studied it, truly enjoyed it. But after the divorce, no more violin. And when the time came in fourth grade to decide what instrument I should play, this is in Pasadena, California, back when they had terrific music programs, I fell in love with the cello. I really wanted to play the cello, and so my father took me to the music store. And I was standing there holding his hand, and my father expressed his son's wishes to the salesman. And the salesman said, well, we have this nice Roth cello appropriate for him, and it rents for $75 for 1 year. This was in 1965. And I could feel his hand tense up. The salesman, knowing his business, immediately smiled to my father and said, well, maybe something a little bit less expensive, such as one of the woodwinds, say a clarinet. And my father said, in a monotone I hadn't heard before and haven't really heard since, no son of mine will play the clarinet. Well, the clarinet was $45 an hour, a year, excuse me. It is about $45 an hour now. So then he said, well, in the brasses, we have the trombone, which is for $25 a year. And the guy pulled up the trombone and showed its nice slide on it, and it's shiny. And I liked everything about it, but I didn't like the name trombone. Something about that bothered me. And I said so. And then the guy said, well, perhaps the trumpet, Mr. Walp, to my father, the trumpet rents for $15 for 1 year. And my father looked down at me, and I looked up at him, and he said, son, you're going to be a wonderful trumpet player. And as it turns out, many, many, many trumpet players play that instrument for all of the same reasons, for just purely because it's the least expensive one to rent. But anyway, that's how I came to play the trumpet. That's it.
And didn't you have some early lessons with your father on this trumpet?
Oh, that very day, we rent the trumpet. He drives immediately to the public library, looks in the card catalog, that dates me certainly, and goes to the stacks and finds the thickest trumpet method book he can find. It's by Jean-Baptiste Arban. It's a tome I have played out of even today. And so he took this home, and he sat down at the piano, and he started trying to figure out how to get a buzz. He'd played tenor sax fairly poorly, but he'd been around trumpet players. And so he had an idea that you buzz the mouthpiece. And reading the translated the text, he figured out that, okay, so if I can just get the buzz right on the right pitch, then well, he was a physicist. He says, then if you put that into the trumpet, you ought to get a sound. So he's sitting at the piano, and he finally gets out a pretty good buzz after 5 or 6 minutes. And holding the mouthpiece while buzzing it, docks the trumpet, the resonating device, onto the sound, the signal source. And lo and behold, a sound comes out. So he finds it on the piano. He was fingering a low C on the trumpet, but the note that came out was a B flat, one step too low. And this really puzzled him. And then he realized, it's trumpet in B flat. Oh, that's like tenor sax in B flat. That's a step below C. So now I can figure out what to do. If you can buzz the note and expect it to come out one note lower, then you can figure out, you can just start buzzing pieces. So he and I started buzzing pieces on the mouthpiece, including bugle tunes from a Boy Scout bugler's, mm-hmm. bugler's merit badge book. And he got me doing that really before I played the trumpet. And what's interesting is that after all of these years of doing lots of solfège and all sorts of fancy things in music, that is basically my approach to playing the instrument today. It's a, you know, 55 years later.
And there's a name for that, right?
Well, it's solfège. Most people know the annoying do re mi song from The Sound of Music, and from that you learn all the relationships between half steps and whole steps, and you learn how to sing into the trumpet by actively making a vibration into the instrument rather than responding to the instrument by putting down valves and kind of hoping for the best.
So it's really all you.
Exactly. And I mean, my brother's a nice, really good pianist, and he used to remark that, man, I go downstairs and I hit the piano, I sound great right away. You spend 30 minutes just trying to get a sound out. And that's the difference between an active instrument and a passive one. But it's the same thing. It's the same thing as the human voice.
Oh, that's true. And in fact, I have only recently realized, I say recently because 10 years to someone at my age is recent, that the voice is an instrument. I really hadn't recognized that when I was younger. So, you know, this concept that you play one note, or you hear a note, but you respond by playing a note lower when you're playing with other people. I've heard from musicians in Nashville, where I lived for a while. So Jimmy Jones was a bass player who played with Vince McGill, and he would tell us how on the road, if Vince was hoarse, he'd go to the strings, the lead guitar and the rhythm guitar, and he'd say, you know, just drop it down a few notes, I'm kind of hoarse tonight. But the bass player was like, there's not just an easy method to drop it down a few notes. I have to come up with a whole new...
entirely different scheme for playing.
Yes.
Yeah, very much.
Yes. And so that's quite something to have to do on your feet. And you had also mentioned to me that when the music accompanies, say, an opera singer, sometimes people have to do that?
Yeah, it's not quite as frequent nowadays, but it used to be very common when you'd be in an opera performance back in the days when the Houston Symphony was playing in the pit for the Houston Grand Opera, something I missed terribly. we were early on in my career, which is 35 years ago, early on you'd see the conductor point with two fingers down, and that meant add two flats, or it's just like going into B flat, lower it one step. And that was because the soprano was not having a good day or a good night or whatever, or the tenor wasn't. It's usually sopranos and tenors that cause you to do that. Nowadays, I think that's almost unheard of. But it used to be that the whole orchestra would transpose in a moment's notice. Now, that's a pretty impressive accomplishment for a whole group of musicians. On the other hand, it sounds really weird to the listener. It just screws up the harmonic flow terribly.
I suppose if you're concentrating on the voice instrument from the opera singer, then you're only hearing the symphony as the background. But if you're focusing on the symphony, you're going to hear this strange music. Well, let me take a moment here to say hello to Radioland. This is KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, kpft.org, live streaming in the universe. And I am Mary Edgerton, hosting tonight with our guest Robert Wall, a professional trumpeter. Bob, I just need to mention that as I was putting together some notes, I began to say, okay, Bob talked about not being clarinet player, which is a clarinetist. So is a trumpeter a trumpetist? And I thought, I've never heard of that. So I had to go online. And in fact, you're a trumpeter. You are a trumpeter. Now, I wonder if we could play a recording of you playing a trumpet solo so that we can actually listen to this very exquisite sound on its own. And I think you picked out a particular track 7, for us to start with.
Yeah, this is from a recording project I got involved with about 10 years ago. Oh, there it goes. Anyway, it's a piece by Blazevich, and here it is.
Thank you.
Okay. And sorry I interrupted that piece, but I'm amazed at the delicate notes coming out of a trumpet, which I associate with oompa-pa bands.
Well, anybody can play a brass instrument loudly. After you've owned one for about 6 minutes, you can do that. I mean, every inebriated football player with a vuvuzela proves that. Somebody once said, if you know anything about music, then you'll get this, that playing loudly on a trumpet impresses me just as much as playing softly on a clarinet.
Okay.
Anybody can do it.
So I think there's another track that we can listen to now. There was track two on this piece. And what is the name of this piece again?
Oh, these are two Russian etudes. I studied for a bit with the solo trumpet in the Bolshoi in Moscow. And he showed these to me. And I also studied with Vincent Shikowitz in Chicago. And he knew these pieces. And both men approached the pieces very differently. And I just love them to death. They were published out of copyright in the early 1960s in Moscow on acid, what's the opposite of acid-free? Filled with acid paper. You touch it, it dissolves in your hands.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And so they're really hard to find. A lot of people have these as umpteenth generation Xeroxes, but I found one when I was in Moscow. And so I set to recording a bunch of them, and one of these days I'll issue it.
Beautiful. So let's listen to this next one. So I have to say the second track sounded at a more allegro speed than the first track, which is very andante, or slow. But both very lovely. Although I have to say, if I walked away, I would say track seven felt like ribbons floating in the air.
Ah, that's poetry.
So back to your story about your dad and you sitting at the piano and him learning how to teach you about the trumpet. How did he understand the concept of note down, note up, this transposition concept so well? Was he also a musician?
No, he was a physicist. An old musical joke is, are you a musician? And no, I play the saxophone, or no, I play the drums or whatever. In this case, he played the saxophone pretty poorly in a high school jazz band in the 30s in Tennessee. He just didn't have it but he really loved music. He felt it viscerally. And I would say even much more so than my mother, the trained, successful musician. But what was interesting in that he sat down and figured out with hardly any context, he figured out what transposition was and what I would have to do to get us to play a C on the trumpet, then you got to play a B flat on the piano. And he just remembered, oh, that's right, the tenor sax was in B flat, trumpet's in B flat. And that's something that isn't a musical skill. That's a major brilliance of intellect, because he never had any instruction in this at all. But he got his bachelor's and master's in physics at Caltech under Dick Feynman. So
did he go on and finish a PhD?
Yeah, he was in the PhD program, but he did not finish it just because, I mean, I think there was so much happening. He had a wife he was about to divorce. He had a business he had started, and he was working another, I think, basically full-time job. And with, four or five kids, that's already a heck of a lot. But we were around all these physicists all the time, including Richard Feynman, who was a very, very fine player of conga drums, and inveterate womanizer and chaser of, he chased the skirts of his own students' wives and et cetera. He was just an absolute monster in that department. On the other hand, just a delightful, lighter than air kind of person, just a really neat person to be around, at least for a 7-year-old kid.
And did your dad have a good relationship with him?
Not great. My father's brother-in-law, my uncle, got his PhD at Caltech and taught physics at Dartmouth for years, and they got along great, but it was that fellow, it was that Leish Huggins, who said, he says, your dad had the smarts. I don't know what it was. I don't know what it was, but he was better suited towards actual engineering and stuff like that. So he eventually started a telephone company in Alaska and did very well with that.
Oh, that's pretty amazing, a telephone company in Alaska. Yeah. So I have to say, I know a little Richard Feynman story. Of course, to anybody who's not in physics, you may not know who he is, although he's written some really delightful books.
I think everybody would know, most people would know, that he was the guy who solved the explosion of the Challenger.
That's true. I forgot about that. Well, he was the one.
That wonderful news conference where he took a piece of the O-ring and put it into ice water. And that is vintage Dick Feynman.
That is
so clear.
I had forgotten about that.
I mean, all of these complexities. And what did he do? He didn't involve himself in the commission. He drove down to the coast of Florida and talked to the people who worked at coffee shops and got the scuttlebutt. And then he figured out it's got to be something.
It froze the night before. Exactly. And they were spraying water on the shuttle to keep it from freezing.
And NASA was trying to live up to, at the time, they really wanted everybody to think the shuttle was this thing that kept, it comes up, it goes up, it comes back down. You basically do nothing to it, which is anything but the case.
And yes, because I remember hearing on the radio, I didn't hear Dick Feynman. And as a physicist, I knew who that was. And he was a character. There's a great book, Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, that some guy stuck, somebody stuck an O-ring into a glass of ice water and pulled it out and showed everybody that it couldn't deform normally anymore. And I got to work and I said, oh my God, there's some brilliant guy on that commission. And some guy said, yeah, Richard Feynman.
Right.
Right. We would expect that. But as a womanizer, I do have a story. There was an institute for gravitational relativity held at the University of Texas in the summer before I was a freshman in physics. And the chairman of the department invited Richard Feynman to come and participate, which he did. And he invited Richard Feynman to stay at his home. And there were two versions of the story. One was that he tried to seduce the chairman's wife, and the other one was that he succeeded in seducing the chairman's wife. And the conclusion was the same. He was never welcome back at UT again. So at that time, I was sad. I would never see him. But let's go a little further in combining this physics, which we've gone off on a tangent about, and math and music. So to me, physics is the basis of all science. Math is the basis of physics. And music includes both, from counting, timing, scales. And then sound waves, which really transmit the music, and the sound waves and the resonance and the length of your instrument are all described by physics. Yes, I like to ramble on about physics, but how did you end up in music and not physics with this physics background?
Well, my older brother was doing, he was like the first oboe in the all-state orchestra in high school, but also decided to go to graduate from high school early a year, and then he went to USC on a science scholarship, and he was the big man on campus. And then my older sister got into Caltech, but went to McGill, also heavily in science, and I was having so much fun playing. I was in the high school back in Pasadena. We had a really good orchestra and a really good band, wind ensemble, and each was taught by performing musicians. I mean, not very much different than here. So many of in Southern California, you have so many musicians who travel, who and like they were getting off of big bands and stuff. They'd end up in Southern California, and they'd get a job in a school system, so they could get a pension. Later on, it was pension and health care. But you had these, like, I'd walk into the band hall and I'd see my bassoonist band director sitting in the corner with a bassoon, with a strobe tuner to one side and a metronome to the other, practicing and playing a lick and not getting it, and playing something and then saying the S word, and then playing something and saying another word, then finally slowing it down. And learning from people who are players is just so ideal. That guy never had to yell at anybody to go practice. He walked the walk. He didn't talk it. There was no hypocrisy there. And I loved him for it. And also my orchestra director sang jingles. They both did a lot of commercial work. Mm-hmm. The band director, a couple of times, disappeared for 3 days, calling in, quote, sick, unquote, and then showed up 2 weeks later with a new car because he got a movie date. He didn't get... So these guys, their credibility was just terrific. And that's one of the things in the brass band I enjoy, which I guess we're going to talk to eventually, that you got so many people in there who are music educators who are real, genuine players. And their kids do really well. Their kids have an advantage.
That's great. Now, you did tell me a little story about you as an infant that almost... foreshadowed or predicted that you would go into music. And that's a great story. It combines a great physicist and your parents and music.
Yeah, my great uncle was the late John Archibald Wheeler, whom we knew as Uncle Johnny, who had 5 students win Nobel Prizes in physics. And he never got one, even though he coined the term and invented the idea of wormholes and black holes. And he suffered great... There were many detractors for about 30 years.
Yeah.
And until that became accepted. I remember him getting called at a conference. My father said he was at a conference someplace, and somebody goes, oh, that's old Wormhole Wheeler. Well, Johnny Wheeler was a terrific, terrific gentleman, and I got to know him in his later years, but I don't remember what happened, but I'm told by my parents that they were visiting him when he was in running the Institute for Advanced Studies in Princeton, and when he was... Titularly, he was Einstein's boss. He signed Einstein's checks. Of course, we didn't. Nobody thought to save any of those. But the Wheelers put me up, and along with my parents, and I slept in his sock drawer. They didn't have a crib. But then he thought it'd be a good idea for me to go hear the Philadelphia Orchestra.
How old were you?
I was 6 or 7 months old.
Okay.
And I was one pain in the rear kid. I screamed. I was the king of projectile vomiting and screaming and being ornery. And I think many of my friends who know me now will find this completely believable. But any case, so my mother took me and was standing in the back of the Academy of Music. And I don't know if it was Ormandy or Stokowski or walks out to conduct. But as soon as the orchestra quieted down and the A was sounded for tuning, they told me I became completely quiet and calm, and I was that way all the way through the concert, and then I immediately reverted to my prior behavior.
So you were destined to be a musician. I guess I would say as a physicist that you were now relaxed in the ground state in the presence of music, and this becomes an observation which fixes you in the ground state. But tell me more. I'm hearing physics, and where did the music come from? You mentioned your father played the saxophone, but not well. So where did the music come in your family?
Well, my mother's side were good Irish Catholic family. My mother was one of 4 girls, and they all were going to play musical instruments. And they were very successful as a piano quartet, but also individually. My aunt just retired from principal second violin of the Cincinnati Symphony, but they all played. They all did a lot of work. My mother did a lot of studio work and movie work, and she's in a bunch of movies too. She would be she would be playing in a studio for one recording session, and a producer would come in. At one time, it was a producer and Cary Grant, and they made the announcement, we need to pull out all the young people out of this because we need to have an on-screen young ensemble. And so she went over and to another studio. They gave her costumes, and that she plays in this orchestra under the very bad conducting of Cary Grant.
That is funny. Okay, I'm gonna mention to you that while I don't know much about John Wheeler as a musician, and we have of course been bringing in a little bit of a physics accent, as I mentioned, Richard Feynman, your father's mentor, was famous for his playing of the bongo drums, and in fact, he made several teaching videos on topics in physics, and they were famous for him opening with the bongo drums. And so, speaking of drums, I'm gonna play a drum roll here for Nicole and Tatiana. Let's see. Drum roll, drum roll, drum roll! So we are here on So What's Your Story broadcast live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. at KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville, or live streaming on kpft.org. We look forward to our weekly show and the opportunity to be an important part of the Houston storytelling scene. And it's a hot scene. And it's not just the weather. It's a hot scene. Okay, I know that even though we are the only live radio storytelling show, there are other storytelling venues in our community. So, Nicole and Tatiana, can you tell us about some of these?
Yes, Mary, of course. Let me first say something about our show. If you don't have a radio, it's no excuse for missing it, because you can listen to us stream live on kpfd.org or with Facebook Live on our So What's Your Story Facebook page. But yes, there are some other important storytelling venues in and around town. Let's start with the Houston Storytellers Guild. Join them, because it's the best group to work with to start cultivating your storytelling talent. Just get to their monthly story swaps held the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel at 1500 Sunset. Go to their website, www.houstonstorytellers.org, for upcoming events in all of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008 listed on the menu under radio program.
So I have to tell you guys, someone was in my office today saying, are you still doing the radio show? And I said, as a matter of fact, I'm doing it tonight. And as I'm talking to them, they said, well, what's it like? And I went to HoustonStorytellers.org, pulled up radio show, and pulled up a show and started playing it. So you can listen to many or one or any of your favorite topics. I love it. Okay, sorry to interrupt. I just love those oldies but goodies. Keep going.
Well, we also post on our YouTube channel, so check out our program clips there as well, and tell us what you are thinking about our shows or suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. We promise to get back to you, and please be sure to share our page with your friends, and oh yes, we'd love it if you like it before you leave. Like it, love it, and share it. Don't forget our friends also at the Moth Warehouse Live every second Tuesday of the month. The next one will be on July 10th, and the theme is age. So, Mary, you and Hank should be up for that. No shade, no shade.
So, Hank, I remember when she said something about how you and she needed to go home and take a nap when the show was at 10 o'clock at night. Oh, yeah. But that zinger makes a great segue into what's happening next Wednesday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT 90.1. So, Nicole, you will get Hank's forgiveness with this one.
So, I mean, I'm sorry ahead of time, but Dr. Hank will be back next week, and he will be hosting storytellers who know stories better than most. They are Joy Preble and Laurel Graveline, excuse me, both children's specialists at Brazel's Bookstore, one of the last remaining independent bookstores in the country. It's Brazos, not Brazos.
Right. Thank you.
It's okay.
I have to put on my teeth to be articulate, so you'll have to.
You know what I do, and I do have my teeth on. Yeah. I promise, mm-hmm. with my spectacles.
And mm-hmm. I called you what, Rochellen for
me? Yes, and she still misspells my name. I don't understand. But you know, back to
just understand that when I was in school, we did have a history department. So when you talk about age, you know, you just want to be.
Hey, I had a geography department.
Back in my day, I remember.
And I loved card catalogs, Bob. I just wanted you to know.
I remember Montgomery.
Most
Ward.
People don't even know a library exists, let alone card catalogs. So there's that.
Well, I remember Montgomery Ward. How about that? Okay, but the wonderful folks at the Brazos Bookstore are great friends of our So What's Your Storytelling community and KPFT. And next week promises to be a program not to be missed. But why would you want to miss any of our shows anyway? And since Hank is going to focus on children's stories, which I personally love, we will give him a pass on age because he still appears to be young at heart. What about you, Mary?
Oh, me?
No shade.
Me? As the baby of the family, I will always be considered young, even if not young at heart. Once the baby, always the baby. And Hank, I'll be tuning in next week. So back to our storytelling. And I think we left you shortly a little ago as a baby. Well, let's move forward, Bob. You've had a career. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing in Houston and about the Houston Brass Band.
Well, many decades ago, I had the good fortune to win an audition in the Houston Symphony, and I'm still there. I'm in my 36th year, and playing in. Wow, as marvelous a trumpet section as I've ever known. We had a really great one in the 90s, back when Christoph Eschenbach was the music director. But I dare say the fellows I'm playing with now outstrip that bunch. I am so thrilled to have Mark Hughes, John Parker, and Rich Harris as my colleagues. So that's a whole lot of fun. But I also do direct the Houston Brass Band, which is a British-style brass band. Not a lot of folks know what a British-style brass band is, but in Houston in the late 90s, some brass players saw the charming little British film from, I guess, 95 or 96 called Brassed Off. Now, that's the true story of the Grimthorpe Colliery Band. That's a colliery is a coal mine. And almost every industrial concern or governmental agency or any sort of company, even in the Midlands, the industrial Midlands of England, has a brass band associated with it. And so the one associated with this Grimthorpe coal mine was beginning to do very well and beginning to do really well. Now, British brass bands are very competitive, and there's this whole series of competitions and different leagues you're in. It's very much reminiscent of what we call soccer, football, and it culminates in the British Nationals. Well, the Grimthorpe Colliery Band made it into the Nationals, even as the Thatcher government was shutting down the coal mine, which was profitable. They were doing it to break the unions back. What happened to the miners and all the players in the brass band are all volunteers, they're all coal miners, was that they went from a full salary to 28% of their salary, that is being on the dole, immediately upon being turned out of their jobs, or what the Thatcherites euphemistically described as being made redundant.
Oh, yes.
That's a really horrid phrase.
It is.
And so the damage done to families and to the whole society in the coal belt, the industrial belt of England, the Midlands, Yorkshire, Lancashire, etc., was terrific. Well, the brass band at the Grimthorpe Colliery decided they were going to go for it anyway. And winning the British Nationals is no small thing. This is really, really quite an accomplishment. And as you can guess, for that they made a movie about it, these guys did win. And they went back to just nothing. But it makes for a very nice family movie. It also makes for an incredibly good soundtrack, because all of the musical selections in the movie are performed by the Graham Thorpe Colliery Band. It's a terrific. The film score alone is terrific.
I have to go find that. And so, what does that have to do with the Houston Brass Band?
Oh, I'm sorry. So these guys, these brass enthusiasts, I
know that story was so great.
These guys,
you could just stop at the end of it.
I'm just telling the plot of a movie. Who cares? But these guys decided they'd want to form a British style brass band. So they set out finding the slightly odd to extremely odd brass instruments in a British style brass band. And they set this thing up in about the year 2000. And I hadn't even heard of them. And I was asked to go visit a rehearsal and maybe coach the cornet players. And I listened to this motley group and I was astounded and appalled and bewildered. How can I don't know where to start. And I'm used to dealing with people on a pretty high level, and there's a great range of pretty bad playing here. Also, I experienced great resistance from a number of them. And I thought, well, once I go home from this, I won't have them to worry about anymore. Well, they called me back the next week and wanted me to coach them more, and then wanted me to conduct. And I had conducted a teeny bit, but I'd never taken a course in it or anything like that. I didn't know what I was doing, and except that I just approached it from, well, I've seen a whole lot of really good conductors and a whole lot of even more really bad conductors. And I know that I can emulate the first, the former, and hopefully to get away from what the others do. And I just, you treat it like chamber music. You look at the score, you know what it ought to sound like, and then you start addressing it. You start fixing things. And they kept asking me back, and in a month or so, they asked me to be their music director. One of the principal solo cornet player in the band, Steve Allred, is a terrific guy. He has a recording of that initial concert, this Christmas concert in 2006, and he holds it over my head like the sword of Damocles. He is blackmailing me with that one. I want him to destroy it. But anyway, the group fairly quickly began to improve, and pretty soon we started raising money, and we were able to move over to Christ the King Lutheran in the Rice Village and play there a lot. Now our resident hall is the Lanier Middle School auditorium in Montrose. It's one of the best little auditoriums I know of. It's terrific for the brass band. But the group's done very well. We've gone on a couple tours. We've made one record. We're now in the process of producing another. We've got a bunch of plans to raise a lot of money, because before we go to Europe, we need to have the same type of the pairs of tubas. And this won't matter to most people. And it didn't matter to me when I started doing this, but having now conducted in Norway some, I know what those things sound like. And so we have a bunch of plans there.
There are so many directions I want to go off on, such as you're planning a tour in Europe?
That's in the offing. As soon as we have the instruments in hand.
Okay.
And so we have a short-term goal, which is pretty impressive, actually, this, at the moment, almost ominous of how much money we need, but we have great support, and we also have places to go and to stay and to help us out when we're over there. Because ideally, I'd like to go over there as much as to have our band members hear how those guys play.
Ah, yes. Well, can we hear a little bit of the Houston Brass Band?
Sure.
I think
the first track on that on the CD is that Edward Gregson Prelude to an Occasion. This is a live performance from several years ago, and it gives a pretty good idea of how we sounded, well, at least then.
You know, I have to say, one of the things I find most remarkable about a band or a quartet or an orchestra is the way the sound fuses into a single note as it comes to you. And you can decompose it into individual sounds, but the integrated note is quite beautiful. And then the other comment I want to make is, that was really exciting, but such a contrast to the very delicate ribbon-like playing the first piece that you were playing solo. The second piece was a little faster, but the first Andante piece, which was just lovely. That was great. I actually attended your performance at St. Arnold's Brewing Company. And to y'all in Radioland, you should look up the Houston Brass Band. They have a website. Their performances are a lot of fun. And are there any upcoming performances that you can announce for us?
Yes, we have one coming up before our summer break. On the evening of Friday, the 3rd of August, we're playing in Bel Air at a new outdoor venue, which we're looking forward to. It's on our website. And anyway, that's the next one for the brass band. And it will feature a brilliant tuba solo by Ollie Jackson, the Tubby the Tuba, famous for children's concerts with symphony orchestras. It's a really good piece of music. In the Houston Symphony, we did it this year again, and I had forgotten how good it is. And especially with Dave Kirk, the symphony principal tuba player, playing it, it's marvelous fun. And I thought, I wonder if there's a brass band version. Sure enough, there are brass band versions of Beethoven's symphonies.
Oh, no.
Yeah. No. But I haven't liked those, but I have really enjoyed the Wagner overtures. So what the heck?
I can imagine a Wagner overture. Yeah. Yes.
Although there's a lot of Wagner that isn't loud brass. It's you know, tweedling in the forest music with a bunch of woodwinds. And when you got to get a bunch of cornet players and tenor horn players to do that, that's an accomplishment.
Well, I need to keep up with this, because if you're going to play a Beethoven or a Wagner, I need to go hear this. I mean, Beethoven's Ninth is, people call it Schmaltz, but it's one of my favorites. Oh, I love it.
I've never heard it called that.
Okay, that was my ex-husband, and maybe now we know why he was my ex-husband.
Yeah, good.
But it's a little hard to imagine. It's, what is it, the pastoral?
The sixth, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, as in a brass band.
Well, you'd be surprised what a brass band can do. I didn't believe in this at all when I started doing it. I just was trying to solve a bunch of problems with amateur musicians. And now that we have so many professionals in the group, people who are playing a lot, you know, we have a principal trombonist, Ryan Rungone, who played under me on Monday night in rehearsal, and this morning he was playing with the Houston Symphony sitting next to me. So there's the really high level, but what these ensembles are capable of in terms of ensemble and musically is really remarkable.
So, Bob, one thing that I found by knowing you and by having you here tonight is you are the consummate storyteller. So have you done this before? So are musicians natural storytellers?
Oh, probably to the with the same percentage as the rest of the general population. But what you notice what I noticed when I joined the Houston Symphony was that actually after several Miller Theater concerts, we would go to a bar and there would be Houston Symphony Story Night. And it was great to sit in and listen to people talk about stories about Leopold Stokowski and Sir John Barbaroli, Andre Previn, all these marvelous conductors and music directors had been in Houston, and to hear the stories and also all the anecdotes and the snide remarks. and so the most of the orchestra was in this bar, but then also there's a whole slew of people from the audience. It was just marvelous to hear these stories. And you know, that's how culture is passed down, by storytelling, you know, around the figurative campfire. That's how it's done.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And without that, you really don't have culture. But it's, you know, culture's passed down through music, through food, through all sorts of things, but especially the lore. That, you know,
yes.
Because I think I learned a lot of what not to do by listening to the really hilarious stories of others.
And, so you didn't want to end up as the
as the
protagonist of
right, exactly.
that story.
Yeah.
So I want to say this has been wonderful. If you had something to say to a young musician starting out on their career, what would you say?
My teacher, Bud Herseth, the first trumpet player in the Chicago Symphony for 54 years, he always answered that question with one word. He said, practice. But I would go further, because you need context. And you've got to study with somebody who has made it as a player. You've got to find really good teachers. Happily, in Houston, Texas, there are a slew of them. I mean, the guys I work with every day, but also the faculties at the University of Houston Moore School and the Rice University Shepherd School are really impressive. Something else, though. Attend live concerts, not just in your genre. Go hear, if you're a classical trumpet player, go hear a jazz band. Go hear a string quartet. Go hear a reggae performance. You will learn from all of them. Above all, though, get to concerts of the genre that you're in. If you want to play in a symphony orchestra, go, and go every week. When I was a student in Chicago at Northwestern, my now colleague and great friend Mark Hughes, the principal trumpet of the Houston Symphony, he and I would be walking across campus after having washed dishes in a sorority, really disgusted with ourselves because we weren't playing well, and, oh, let's go back to practice. And pretty soon I got used to saying, you know what? Another hour forcing things down the trumpet isn't going to help me. Let's go hear the Chicago Symphony. So I'd talk him into it. We'd go to the L, and we'd go down to the Chicago Symphony and hear them. And come back so buzzed and so turned on, and we'd go and play. And we'd be able to play things that we hadn't physically been able to approach before. Michael Jordan once said, if you want to play basketball, okay, you can watch it on TV, but you got to get in the room with those guys and watching them and seeing them and hearing them and seeing and getting the complete experience. Because when you're watching on TV, you're getting 5% of it. Same with us.
That's a wonderful message. That's a wonderful message, and it must be very inspiring to hear musicians. Well, listeners, don't you dare move. We are closing out with some beautiful brass music, but upcoming is Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger, and they're ready in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, keep us in your mind every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. So this is Mary Edgerton, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace. Thank you.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
Get even more from your KPFT listening experience by checking out our HD2 stream. New and improved. Get acquainted with our revamped weekly schedule now at kpft.org. Fear not, nationally syndicated favorites like Democracy Now!, Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Letters in Politics, and Economic Update remain. And good news, our evening schedule now features more local shows, including a stellar mix of public affairs, music, comedy, and Spanish language programming created and produced right here at KPFT. Don't miss a second on HD2. Mouse on over to kpft.org or on TuneIn Radio today. KPFT, Houston.